the Centre for Public Christianity. You're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Justine Toe.
When it comes to Christianity, and I think this could apply to religion more broadly, I often describe the attitude of today's society as being a thin layer of resentment over a sea of apathy. There are many obstacles, and not insignificant ones, that come between people and taking faith seriously. For example, there's the idea that we don't need religion because we have science. Science holds all the answers to life's big questions.
Yeah, and another big obstacle to belief is, and I'm thinking about the tagline for the documentary we're making, how the church is better and worse than you ever imagined. Better and worse. There's also this idea that religion has caused great damage and suffering in the world, and it has in many instances.
Andy Bannister is the director of SOLAS, Centre for Public Christianity in the UK, and the author of the book The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. He's dedicated the better part of his life to encouraging people to consider faith, to think carefully and seriously about it, which is an interesting job in a culture that increasingly, if not already, assumes secularism as the default position. We kicked off our discussion with Andy by asking him about the toughest challenges and objections to faith that he's ever come across.
That's a great question. I'm going to be cheeky and say I want to give two answers. The first answer is I'd say every objection, by which I mean, I think there's a huge danger when you think, oh yeah, I got an easy answer to that. Someone comes up, asks you the question, and without even taking the time to listen carefully, you give them this prepackaged answer. And so I'm always conscious behind any question, behind any objection, there's a person, there's an individual, and I want to be reaching and engaging the individual, not just dealing with the question. But I think of all the questions out there, I think probably questions around sort of suffering and evil and those kind of things. Because although I think there are good philosophical answers and good theological answers, because they involve real hurt and real people suffering, they're tough because you've got to deal with people's actual emotional pain, not just some kind of, you know, intellectual presentation of the Christian faith.
Have you found that personally challenging yourself, though, the question of suffering?
In fact, I learned that lesson personally myself a few years ago. Now, when my wife and I were first trying for a family, we went through a series of miscarriages on the journey to having our first child. And I can remember, you know, sitting there on the couch one night as we were processing, you know, yet another failed pregnancy. And I think it was the first time it really properly occurred to me that, you know, upstairs in my study, I have a whole shelf full of, you know, really good, fat, philosophical books written by some of the greatest minds who've ever lived on the issue of, you know, suffering and God and so forth. But I have no motivation to go and pick a single one up. In fact, if I suggested that to my wife,
she'd bash me over the head with that book.
I needed an answer that dealt with the heart's pain, not so much the head's questioning. There came a time for that, yeah, but that time wasn't then. So yeah, I think I've learned that journey very much from the inside as well as the outside.
When the time comes for addressing the head's questioning, though, and a person is coming from an atheist or agnostic position, Andy says there's a tendency for people to smuggle in value judgments. That is, to think or act in a way that isn't exactly consistent with the idea that we live in a godless universe. He explains this concept with a story. He was in Canada and met with a student who wanted to ask him questions about the Christian faith.
A few years ago, when I was based in Canada, I got an email from a university student asking if I would take him out to lunch and answer his questions about the Christian faith, which I thought was a wonderfully cheeky way of doing it, because I thought he should take me out to lunch, but, you know, there we are. So I took him out to lunch. I took him to McDonald's. I know how to show a university student, you know, high-class dining. And over the course of the lunch, he asked me something like sort of 30 or 40 different questions squeezed into 2 hours. It felt like being machine-gunned with objections, and I did my best to answer each one. And anyway, I didn't think we'd got anywhere, and as we were walking back to the car park, I found myself thinking, what can I say to really make him think as we part? What can I say to put a stone in his shoe at the end of the conversation? And this idea popped into my head. As he opened his car door, I said to him, well, I said, I hope you've enjoyed this lunch. And he went, no, it's been really, really, really good. And I said, well, I hope you've also found me respectful, although I've disagreed with your atheism, that you feel I've treated you with respect and dignity. And he went, yeah, no, you have. That's very kind. And I said, well, that's great. And you've definitely treated me with respect and dignity as well. I haven't felt you've been rude as an atheist. And he thanked me for this. Very polite society in Canada. And and then as he was about to close the car door, I looked at him and grinned. And I said, just one last thought for you. The reason I've treated you with respect and dignity is because I believe that you're a person made in the image of God and that your life bears incredible value and dignity. But you, on the other hand, have told me 3 times this lunchtime that you believe human beings are nothing more than atoms and particles, nothing more than biology. but you haven't treated me as a person just made of atoms and particles. You've actually treated me as a person made in the image of God. In other words, you've treated me this lunchtime on the basis of my worldview, not your worldview. I'm very grateful for that. Have a lovely afternoon. And for the first time, he had nothing to say, just sat there open-mouthed. And in a sense, that wasn't trying to be clever and score points. It was, I don't think you can live in God's world without assuming, even sort of subconsciously, large aspects of the Christian worldview. The moment that you carry on as if human beings have value and dignity, if you believe that truth matters, well, now you've stepped out of atheism and you're operating on the edges of a Christian worldview.
Do you find, though, Andy, that people aren't all that bothered by the inconsistency? Like, on the one hand, they can believe in the existence of beauty, but on the other hand, we are just random kind of accidental products of evolution. Like, they're not really that bothered, or they don't think that deeply about it.
There's two things bound up in that question, Justine. One is, I don't think people think about it. But then you do also get those who I think realise there's an issue. And I remember doing an event at the University of Toronto a couple of years ago. They'd asked me to speak on, can life have meaning without God? I gave that presentation and argued that it couldn't. First man to the microphone was an atheist, in fact, the head of the Secular Alliance there at the time. And his opening question was really interesting. He looked at me and said, you know what, Andy? I agree with you. I've been wrestling with this for some time. I don't think life can have meaning without God. And at times it keeps me awake at night, the grim despair of the world. He said, but that does not prove that God exists. And I looked at him and I said, I absolutely agree with you. My argument is not life is meaningless without God, therefore God. My argument is life is meaningless without God. Now, are you now motivated to talk about God? And then if you are, we can talk about the evidence.
Take human rights, for example.
Let's do just that.
We live in a time where human rights is universally assumed. Does it really matter where the idea that humans have dignity come from if we can just broadly accept the very fact of human rights?
I think we have very narrow historical imaginations, and we forget that human rights and the idea of universal human rights exists in a very narrow sliver of time. We haven't had it for that long, really only since perhaps the 1950s, 1960s, which means don't imagine it's going to be here forever. And there are plenty of regimes in the world who are quite happy to imagine it won't be here forever. I mean, because it's not universal. There are many countries today where you could go and, you know, try standing up and criticizing the political leaders and see what happens to you. And if human rights is just a human invention, then of course the government can give and the government can take away. Might makes right. And don't take my word for it as a Christian. I know before the recording we were chatting and I mentioned a guy called Luc Ferry, who's a French atheist, French philosopher, wrote a book called A Brief History of Thought, which is a great survey of the whole of philosophical history. He's got a very generous chapter in there on Christianity. And he says that one of the legacies of Christianity is the idea that all human beings are born equal. He said that idea is not self-evident. Look around. Some people are rich, some are poor. Some people are, you know, clever, some people are stupid. There's distinctions everywhere. It's far more natural to come up with the sort of idea that Aristotle went for, that people have stations in life. Some people are born to be slaves. Some people are born to be in leadership, and so be it. And Luke says it was Christianity. We have to think for that idea. I think very often in the West today, we've taken on the legacy of Christian thought and then assumed we can hollow out the foundations and the whole edifice will stand up. I'm not sure that it will. And I actually think, almost as a historian now, I think you can just begin to see the beginnings of some quite deep cracks, particularly in Western civilization right now. We live in interesting times.
While the West has a strong legacy of Christian thought running through its society, culture, and politics, I was also interested in asking Andy about whether the Bible and Christian faith has anything to offer people today in the West in a culture that has largely left God behind.
There's a wonderful writer called Oliver James, a British psychologist, not a Christian, who wrote a book a few years ago now called The Selfish Capitalist. And in that book, he sets out, he's just fascinated as a psychologist that, you know, Western society is incredibly affluent. People have, you know, more than ever before, yet incidences of depression and anxiety and stress are off the chart. And he's got the medical data to back that up. It's interesting, actually, in the book, he doesn't really know what the answer is because he hasn't got any kind of religious faith, but he diagnoses it very well. And I see that everywhere. I see it, for example, when I go onto university campuses or into business settings. If I do talks around happiness or meaning or identity or satisfaction, you often have standing room only. People are asking those kind of questions. I think the gospel has something to say to every area of life. I mean, I love the fact, you know, you guys are the center for public Christianity. Christianity is a public truth. One of the mistakes we sometimes make as Christians, though, is to be answering yesterday's questions. I think it was Tim Keller from a New York-based pastor who said that, you know, the way we used to talk about the gospel as Christians was to assume that the person you're talking to is trying to live a moral life, struggling, and so we come along as Christians and go, oh, you're trying to live a moral life. here's Jesus, who lived the life that you should have lived and died for, you know, your sins so that you can have that moral status that you're searching for. So the problem is most, you know, postmoderns and millennials, they're not trying to live a moral life. That's not their main concern. Their main concern is freedom. We want to be free, free to be, free to self-identify, free to, you know, do all manner of things. And that's the struggle, because as human beings, we're not free. We crash into all kinds of constraints. And Tim in that interview said, how do we, you know, think about as Christians how we show that how the gospel uniquely addresses that question? One way to address this, I think, as Christians, is do a lot more listening and a lot less talking.
Now, you mentioned freedom. If our culture believes freedom, or the definition of freedom, to really be about unlimited choices,
yeah,
isn't it the case that any kind of commitment to a faith, yeah, tradition is going to limit those choices and therefore be quite unattractive?
I think so, but I think what we need to do is burst the bubble and go, that's a ludicrous definition of freedom. You'll gather from that, I think it's not true. For example, there are lots of desires that I have, but they're mutually contradictory. You know, I want to be able to run a mile in under 6 minutes. I also want to be able to eat as many donuts as is humanly possible. I'm going to find those two things collide. I'm going to have to make a choice there. On top of that, we run into the natural constraints built into the system. And everything has constraints and limits. And those constraints are often there in most cases to enable something to thrive. So, for example, as a hobby, I'm a drone pilot. I've got a camera drone, love flying it. When I bought this $1,500 drone, one of the instructions in the manual was, do not fly in enclosed spaces such as forests. Last Christmas, it was a windy day. I wanted to fly, couldn't fly anywhere else. Forest near my home, I thought, what could go wrong if I just fly in a sort of openish kind of space in the woods? Well, the answer is you can bounce it off two oak trees and almost destroy a $1,500 drone. That constraint was not there to make life boring. That constraint was so I could enjoy the best my drone had to offer. And like my question really, therefore, is in terms of the Christian faith, is if God is who the Bible describes him to be, the one who created us, the one who wants the best for us, the one who knows what human flourishing and thriving looks like, and also invites us into that relationship of love and commitment, then surely it's worth sacrificing some freedoms for. And of course, more than that, God has taken the initiative, because when he stepped into history in the person of Jesus and went to the cross, he gave up his freedom for us in order to make that relationship possible. So God is not asking us to do anything he has not already done.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity.
Andy Bannister is the director of SOLAS, Centre for Public Christianity in the UK. But he's also a student of world religions. He's completed a PhD in Islamic studies. And a question he's often asked is, aren't all religions the same?
Well, the simple answer to that question is no. The slightly longer version is that I think that was what I first believed. I think it's a kind of common perception until you actually go out and study them. So I'm a Christian. I've been studying Christianity, been following Jesus for, you know, 20, 25 years now. But my PhD is in Islamic studies. And when I began studying Islam, it very quickly became apparent that Islam is a completely different religion to Christianity. In fact, almost anything that Christianity teaches, that the Bible teaches, Islam and the Quran teaches, actually in many cases the complete opposite. And that's not to be disrespectful to Islam. I think that actually when we squish all the religions together, what we actually do is we lose the nuance, we lose the differences, and we disrespect them. It's far more respectful to my Muslim friends to recognize that what they believe is different, and to take the effort to understand those differences, not to assume they're just like me.
What about, Andy, the question of whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God? There is an attempt to harmonise those two different ideas. Do they worship the same God? Are there differences, similarities?
Yeah. There's the question of, does the Quran describe the same God as the God of the Bible? That's, I think, a relatively easy question, and the answer is no. We can look at the attributes, the characteristics of the God of the Bible, and in almost every case, those characteristics are very different in the Quran. So, for example, the God of the Bible is a God who's relational. He's a God who's personal. He's a God who can be known. He's a God who is described as being love, and he's a God who has suffered primarily in the person of Jesus and the cross. And those are core parts of the Bible's description of who God is, his character. Read the Quran, and the Quran denies each of those characteristics. Now then, are some Muslims yearning after and seeking after the God of the Bible? I think they are. When I meet a Muslim who tells me they believe that God is love, for instance, what I want to gently say to my Muslim friends is, you know, I completely agree with you. I think God is love, but the God you've described to me is not the God of the Quran. That's the God of the Bible.
And what sort of response have you received?
That changes the whole conversation. I remember a year or so ago, I was at a Canadian university, and I just finished doing a lunchtime event on the historicity of the resurrection, and I was hanging around afterwards, and this student comes up to me and says, "Oh, Andy, have you got 2 minutes? I've got a couple of quick questions." And I said, "Yeah, sure, fire away." He said, "Well, I'm a Muslim, actually." He said, my first question is, I think the Bible's been corrupted. What would you say?" And my second question is, "Isn't the Trinity incoherent?" And I said, "My friend, that needs more than 2 minutes." I said, "How long have you got?" He looked at his watch. He went, "I've got 3 hours." I went, "Okay, you keep buying the coffee, I'll keep talking." So we dealt with the first question in about the first 45 minutes. And then we moved on to the second question. And what I basically did with him, I said, "Look, do you mind if I just start with the beginning of the Bible and work through from the very first book of the Bible to the very end, give you the great biblical framework for understanding who God is, why Christians believe that God is Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and why I think that's profoundly different from the God of Islam?" And he said, "Yeah, sure, do that." So I did it. I took about an hour, actually. He was incredibly patient. At the end, it was really interesting, Justine. He looked at me and he said, "That's the first time I've ever heard anyone explain these things in a way that makes sense. In fact," he said, it's almost beautiful. I could understand why somebody would want to believe this." So I looked at him and I went, "Well, do you believe it?" He went, "No." But he said, "It is compelling."
But what you're talking about is actually respecting the religion enough to take seriously what it says about itself, right?
I think so. And I'd say two other things there, Simon, or actually maybe three other things. Firstly, it's interesting that with the very greatest respect to people who ask that question, you know, what passes for sort of, you know, informed comment around religion wouldn't pass muster anywhere else. I mean, if you got onto an aircraft and the pilot came across the tannoy before, you know, taking off from Sydney to say, "Hey, I've been thinking about this whole, you know, sort of physics and laws of flight thing, and I think it's far too prescriptive. I've come up with my own version of, you know, sort of flight dynamics, and, you know, there are numbers and things in there. Don't worry, people." I think we'd all be running for the emergency exits. Truth is truth is truth, and I think we try and avoid that, but I think we all know instinctively deep down that in the real world, you sort of butt up against reality, right? But two other things very quickly. I think lying behind that statement that you just said there, I think many people have this idea that, look, God, if he or she exists, is this sort of vague sort of personality, life force out there somewhere, like the Force in Star Wars or something. You know, maybe we can work out a few things about God. And of course, that's what the different religions of the world are, right? It's mankind's best attempt to work out what God is like. And that's what Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, and Christianity is. And of course, if that's true, it's incredibly arrogant for me as a Christian to say Christianity is superior or true in a way that Islam isn't. I mean, why is my best guess better than someone else's best guess? Now, if that is what religion is, that accusation would be completely the case. But that's not the Christian claim at all. The Christian claim is not that God is some sort of fog out here that we have to try and work it out, nor that Christianity is man's best guess. The Christian claim is that Jesus is, as it were, someone come to us out of the fog to say, "Let me tell you what it's like in there. Let me show you what God is like." And I always want to bring it back to the question of who Jesus is. At the end of the day, for me, it's the question is not so much, is Christianity true or a better system of thought than Islam? My question primarily is, are the claims that Jesus made about himself true? And if they are, I need to put my money where my mouth is and follow. If they're false, it's a load of dangerous nonsense. And we can ask the same of Muhammad. Are the claims that Muhammad made for himself true? Do they stand up? And if they're true, then we need to take them seriously. And I think the claims of Jesus stand up, and I think the claims of those others don't.
Andy studied the Bible and the Quran, and for himself came to the conclusion that the Bible and the Christian faith was more convincing. But that's not to say that there aren't things in the Quran and Islamic faith that caught his attention.
The Arabic of the Quran is very, very beautiful. It's a beautiful piece of literature. And I have no time for anybody who, in saying that Islam is false, wants to dismiss the whole thing. The classical Arabic of the Quran is very, very beautiful. Islam built an incredibly impressive civilization. You can look at Islamic art and contributions to, you know, to philosophy and some of the early sciences and other things. Amazing things there. And likewise, Muhammad, I would say, you know, I think Muhammad as a political leader, as a military leader, is incredibly impressive up there with someone like Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan or those would be where I'd compare him in terms of what he did and the kind of the results he achieved. That doesn't, of course, mean that his claims are true. And sometimes we can conflate those things. And then secondly, I think important to say, you know, I've had hundreds if not thousands of conversations now with Muslim friends over the last 20 years or so. And a number of things I like. I love and admire the fact that Muslims take their faith very, very seriously. And, you know, I often spend my time talking to atheists. It can be quite exhausting. You know, you're starting from sort of first principles. My Muslim friends, they believe there's a God. They believe that God works in history. They believe, you know, a lot of the foundational stuff that we can build on as Christians. That's very refreshing. And then also, I think, finally, I think the place of the family, I think, in much of the Muslim world is hugely admirable. I think here in the West, radical individualism is so rife in our culture. And I love spending time in the Middle East, where it's very, very different, where the community and the family are so important. I think there's something we could learn there.
You've mentioned, Andy, the very beautiful claims and practices that you can find in Islam. What about politics? You know, is Islam necessarily political in a way that, is there an uncomfortable relationship there, perhaps?
Very simply, yes, is the simple answer. For a very good reason. I mentioned a moment ago that Muhammad was a warrior. He was a military man. And that means particularly the second half of the Quran that he preached while he was in political leadership in Medina, there in the Arabian Peninsula, is very tied up with politics. And so Islam is in many ways a political system. And extricating, you know, a sort of non-political Islam out of the Quranic sources, I think is very, very difficult. And I think one of the reasons we're faced with some of the tensions and difficult conversations we're having now in the West, vis-a-vis how does Islam fit with a modern Western political pluralistic democracy, come from the fact that Islam was never designed to be understood that way. Whereas Christianity, because the first Christians were a persecuted minority within the Roman Empire, there was never any attempt, I think, by Christians to sort of think through, hey, what happens if we're in charge and how do we, you know, how do we merge our faith and our politics? It was really more, how do we stop the political powers oppressing us and destroying us? Where in Islam, it was, well, hang on a minute, you know, politics and religion belong together. And Muhammad had this passionate love of the Arabic people. That comes through when you read the early literature. And I think he felt that, you know, he looked around, there were these great empires, the Byzantine Empire, the Persian Empire, and here were the Arabs with nothing. How do you build an empire? And he got it into his head, the way you build an empire is you use religion. These other great empires around us, they've figured out that religion is the way to do this. And that's what he desired to do for his people, the Arabs. And I'd argue he succeeded. But it does mean you've now got this mess where Islam is political from top to bottom. And I think trying to build a non-political Islam, I think it can be done. I think it probably can, but it requires a huge amount of work. And I don't think what you can do, with all respect to my moderate Muslim friends, is cherry pick the verses you like out of the Quran and ignore the difficult ones. I think you need to face up to how it was formed, the shape that it's in, and then do some tough thinking.
You mentioned earlier that Muhammad was a warrior as
yes.
well. What do we do with the role of conquest in the growth of Islam?
Look, Christians have got themselves involved in all kinds of military misadventures. Good example, the Crusades. But here's where the important differences come out. As a Christian, I am broadly willing to put my hand on my heart and condemn the Crusades and say, whoever had the bright idea of painting the symbol of the cross, which is a symbol of one to whom violence was done, onto military equipment, marching across Europe, killing Jews on the way, and then going and causing a bloodbath in the Middle East, absolutely antithetical with the person and claims of Jesus. To my Muslim friends, I want to say, well, hang on a minute, I've just repudiated the Crusades. What about the Islamic conquests? Those first two centuries of the Islamic era, where Islam conquered huge parts of the ancient world. 20 years of dialoguing with Muslims, Justine, I have not met a single Muslim yet who is willing to condemn the conquests. And that tells me there's a problem here. And the other problem here, I think, comes of when you compare Jesus and Muhammad. This is where it all goes back to. I think Muhammad is the elephant in the room. And I can illustrate it this way. Look, if I meet a Christian who is inclined towards being violent or racist or oppressive, I want to grab that Christian and drag them back as close to Jesus of Nazareth as I can and say, look at the example. Look at the person whose name you're claiming to be as a Christian. What are you doing? If I meet a Muslim who is inclined towards violence and being oppressive and all those kind of abhorrent behaviors, I want to get them by the hand and drag them as far away from the historical Muhammad as I can possibly get them, because the sources aren't going to help. The direction of travel is opposite. Muhammad was one who used violence. He was no worse than the other leader of the time period. Let's not demonize him, but let's put him in his context. Jesus, on the other hand, radically different, one to whom violence was done, one who never shed the drop of anyone's blood. And I think when we're looking at a world today where people are riven apart by their differences, how do we find a way of gluing people together? I think we need someone who shows us the way of the peacemaker, not the way of the warrior.
Well, finally, Andy, as someone who spends a lot of time defending and promoting Christian faith, why do you do what you do? What gets you out of bed in the morning? Why do you get excited about this?
What gets me out of bed in the morning is definitely having two children under five. That gets you out of bed in the morning. Now, why do I do this? I do this with a passion for a number of reasons, but the primary one, I would say, is I think Jesus is the most incredible person that you can meet. I think the news of what he's done and who he is, what he's done for us, is the most incredibly exciting and liberating and life-transforming news on the planet. And out of that, I want to share that news with other people. It's, you know, analogous to perhaps, you know, to realizing that you've discovered the cure for cancer. And if you discover the cure for cancer, are you going to just sit there and go, oh, this is interesting, this is the cure for cancer, I wonder what's on telly? Now, if you've discovered this and you believe it and you've seen the difference it makes to people, you're going to be out shouting it from the rooftops, promoting it, tweeting it, finding ways to get people to say, look at this, this could change your life forever. And I think for myself and many other people I know who've met and encountered Jesus and had their lives turned around, it's so exciting and it's so incredible. You want other people to discover the same thing that you have. Not because that you think you're cleverer than them, just because it's such an amazing discovery that you've made. It's all about who he is, not who I am, that I want other people to discover and see the same thing that I have.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Justine Toe.
We've been speaking with Andy Bannister, the director of SOLAS, Centre for Public Christianity in the UK, and author of The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, or The Dreadful Consequences of Bad Arguments. You can buy it in bookstores and online. If you want to hear this conversation again, or more like it, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating or review. It helps people discover our show.
Next week, is our world becoming more or less religious?
Suppose you would not be a Christian or a Muslim and you live in 2050 and two-thirds of the world will be Christian or Muslim. You will be a stranger on the planet if you don't understand the Christian faith or the Muslim faith.